This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula Bill Russell, and I'm with Malcolm Gladwell. We were talking about, as the world gets more and more complicated, the need for basic ability to interact. And you talk about that at some length from three or four different perspectives in The Tipping Point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think we tend to overlook the fact that, you know, well, actually we don't. We're kind of obsessed with the extent to which the world is becoming more complicated. But what, to me, the interesting part of that is that that forces a kind of reorganization of the way we arrange our world, our social relationships. Certain kinds of things become more, you know, I was, you know, to use the example of my brother again, if you think back 30 years, or even 25 years, before the kind of computer revolution, when you were in high school, the person who could handle the slide projector or whatever it was called was the techie guy, right?
The AV guy.
The AV guy. Now, the AV guy was a certain type of person. And the whole point of the AV guy was that he had a kind of knowledge which you had zero interest in, right? You would never need to have that knowledge.
Because he was going to do it.
He was going to do it. You didn't care. He didn't have any kind of social cachet. He was just this nerdy kid who somehow liked working the slide projector. Now we're in a world where that kind of technical knowledge is not something that you can push off to the fringes anymore. It's something that we all need. Every one of us has the equivalent now of the slide projector in our house, or the movie, the film projector, whatever it was called.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, that the AV guy is not someone who's a social outcast. He's someone who all of a sudden has got real social currency.
And everybody wants to know
everybody
him.
Everybody wants to know him. Everyone, all of a sudden, that kind of person can partake in the world and the social world in a way that
they can go to cocktail parties and have something to talk about.
Because
people want to talk to the guy who knows about computers. Yeah,
not only that,
isn't
people want to, and it's not, I don't mean this in a cynical way. I mean, an awful lot of what friendship is, at least in the beginning, is the exchange of useful information. And what we've done is, as the world gets more and more complicated, more and more kinds of people all of a sudden have a seat at the table, who used to be on the kind of fringes of, we all need this kind. They're suddenly central in a way they weren't central before. And that's one of the, to me, one of the really interesting things about, and wonderful things about the increasing complexity of the world. And that is that it gives all kinds of people a seat at the table who weren't there before. The AV guy used to be on the fringes. He's not anymore. He's central. That's wonderful.
The middle-aged women used to be at the fringes.
Because now they're, I mean, all, this is a wonderful aspect of the increased complexity of the world.
What is fascinating, there has been over the past a great deal of talk about diversity and all of its manifestations, mm-hmm. and we tend to break it into ethnicity and gender, mm-hmm. and variations on that theme. And you make a very interesting point that it is not the similarities that bind people together, it is the proximity that binds people together. Mm-hmm. And part of what you're talking about in this context is that proximity, but what has also happened with this technology is distance is less of an issue. Mm-hmm. So that proximity now is not, I think, any longer solely geographically based, that there can be proximate groups. I mean, you can have a techie friend on the West Coast, and that can be a proximate relationship in a way that it was not before.
Yeah, we can construct what these technologies have given us is the freedom to construct our own social networks that aren't constrained in the same way by physical location. Although I do think, you know, physical location is still awfully important.
Well, we are sitting here.
Yes,
we are
all
sitting here.
And it's a different experience.
But this, you know, I think of it, I thought of this, if I might bring up one of my little hobby horses. You know, one
hobby
of my great
horses.
Hobby horses is affirmative action. I'm a huge fan of that. And I think that one of the problems people have who are opponents with it is that they tend to define diversity the benefits of diversity very narrowly. But just thinking about it in the context of what we've been talking about, what is valuable about an education that gives you access only to a narrow slice of society? If social power is as central as it is, and we all have to concede now this is a critical issue, you know, part of what is making someone wealthy, part of what making someone prepared to deal with the world, part of educating them is in giving them access to all parts of it. That's part of what it means to be a connected, you know, 21st century, you know, you can make a case for affirmative action entirely in very practical, if you want economic, you know, you don't have to go to all kinds of level. You're not doing someone a favor here. you are creating the most valuable educational experience
for
everyone.
This is a social good.
Yeah, for everyone
and,
involved.
And demonstrably a social good. There's another piece of that, it seems, that almost never seems to get brought up in the discussions about affirmative action, and it's the importance of networks in getting jobs.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, you talk about the weak link is more important than the strong link.
You know, we assume that, you know, we at our best would argue for a meritocracy. Mm-hmm. And say that if we, for example, provide equal educational opportunity, then everything else should take care of itself. But without those connections, mm-hmm. then you're in fact not providing equal opportunity, which is right at the heart, I would think, of affirmative action.
Yeah, absolutely. Those kinds of sure, you're plugging people into these enormously powerful networks by giving them access, and it's hard to, once you appreciate the power of that network. It's hard to say that it should be restricted to people, you know, of a particular class or who happen to do well on one metric of achievement.
What I find absolutely sensational about The Tipping Point is that it feels as if it is a cookbook mm-hmm. for how to go make the world better. mm-hmm. Does it feel like that to you?
I hope so. I'm periodically reminded by people that it's also a cookbook for how to make the world worse.
Well, that's true.
I mean,
that's true. There's the nefarious. There's always the shadow side.
You know,
it's in some ways value free.
Yeah, it's. I mean, one of the things that makes me feel like maybe I've made things better than off than they were before is that it struck me that the people trying to do good needed more help than the people trying to do ill
because they already know how to do the bad stuff.
The people who want to do bad stuff are really good at getting the word out. The people who want to do good stuff, I think, have been, you know, need more help and have been. So that's my way of rationalizing what I'm talking about. But
well, in that same vein, you develop a beautiful extended metaphor about people dancing, about people being engaged, about mm-hmm. the physicalness of being with others, mm-hmm. and the ripple effects, the mm-hmm. physical effects, mm-hmm. both of information and of social exchange. It's hard for me to see how anything that powerfully good can also be bad. I am Pollyanna, I confess it. But anything that has that much power for good, it would seem to me that the risk is worth taking.
Yes. No, I do think so. Now, that was that part of the book was when I got very interested in trying to explain what makes certain – what is charisma? Because a lot of what we're talking about here, when we talk about how certain individuals have a certain kind of social power – part of that is bound up in this thing that we call charisma.
That we don't know what it is exactly.
We don't know what it is. And when you look and you try and figure out what it is, you don't see it. Like people always say, and it is true, Bill Clinton has a huge amount of charisma. I actually don't find him a particularly compelling public speaker. It's not that he is the world's most articulate speaker. It's something else. You know, and if you actually find charismatic people, and I did, I actually, for that part of the book, I called up these people who study this, and I said, well, you know, who is the most persuasive man in America? And they said, oh, it's this guy named Tom Gow. And so I went and found Tom Gow and hung out with him. And it's not the thing that you think it is. It's something more subtle and weird and interesting and wonderful in a certain way.
Lots of dimensions.
It's some little kind of vibe. It's this dance that you mentioned. It is somehow they have an ability to sweep us up in their web, in the rhythms of their own speech and gesture, and they seduce us in the best sense of that word. And you can be awfully seductive without being good-looking or without being the world's most articulate person or without being any of these things that we normally associate with social influence.
You talk about how you use the phrase networking when we don't mean the negative part. Mm-hmm. Charisma has that same sort of a double entendre almost, doesn't mm-hmm. it? Are you suggesting that we can learn to do that?
I don't know. I suspect some of us can do better than we do. You know, there are lessons that those of us who are sort of in the normal range, I think, can learn. But the real pure charisma and the real pure kind of connector, that stuff is, you're born with it. I mean, you just have
it. It's hardwired.
You can see it in, every now and again I meet a two-year-old, you know, and I'm sure you've had the same way, 1 in 100 two-year-olds, and you just think, oh my God, this child is going to be
golden.
You know, you've got it. They have it at that age. You know? They have the, whatever that is, that charm, that, they're winning the game at that age, and they'll win the game when they're 50 too.
I read a biography of Napoleon recently, and his life is so implausible. Mm-hmm. And it's not just blind luck. It's not just being at the right place. It's, you know, obviously there was something about this Corsican, this alien, that was able to sweep France and still continues to sweep France off its feet. And I think it's that same kind of intangible you're talking about.
Yeah.
I would think, are we going to
Yeah, we're
going to
go to break, but you can think again in a minute if you'd like. This is Bill Russell, who's going to think soon. He's going to
try to do it in public.
He's going to do it with Malcolm Gladwell, who has written The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference. We'll all be back in just a moment to learn some more about those big differences. Please be with us when we return with The Paula Gordon Show.